very late Thursday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Tonight, from my hotel room in Santa Cruz, where I'm at the D-League Showcase, Danny is safe and sound in his office at his house. What's up, man?
Doing well. How are you?
Not bad. It was a rather interesting TNT game that I didn't get a chance to watch all of because I was at the showcase, but pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, you mean the game that I turned off because the Kings were up like 30, and then all of a sudden I just see Twitter explode and go, oh, I should probably watch now, and I watched the last, I don't know, like the last 8 to 10 minutes of that magnificent disaster.
It was, well, the funny part of it was just that really everybody... The Lakers coming back and beating the Kings would have just been bad for pretty much everyone. It would be bad for the Lakers draft pick. It would be bad for the Kings making the playoffs. It would be bad for the Bulls who want to get the Kings pick. The Sixers really are the only people, probably Sixers fans, are the only ones who should have been rooting for a Lakers win in that game.
And the Utah Jazz.
What do they have for it?
Well, because the playoffs.
Oh, yeah, because they're trying to make the playoffs. Yeah. All right. That's a good point. All right, but that is not why we are here today. We are here to do a mailbag, which is long overdue. It's been about a month or so now. And let's get started. The format this time is we put it up on the Facebook page. You can add your question as a comment. And then if you like someone's question and you want it to get answered, you can like it. And we try to give preference to the ones that have the most likes. And also, generally, if you can keep it to a sentence or two, that'll increase your chances of getting it answered because it's not that interesting to just read someone's questions for 2 minutes.
And also, please don't make statements. Just make questions because if it's a statement, then we're not going to answer it because it's not a question.
Yeah. No, I mean, I wouldn't mind a talk about, like, if someone was just
sure,
like...
Oh, sure, but that yeah. If something that doesn't open the door to a quote to something for us to respond to.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because that's what always people always complain about, right? When reporters are just like, talk about D'Angelo Russell's performance tonight. If someone is just like, talk about D'Angelo Russell, all right, we could do that.
But that's because you and I love talking. You know, this isn't an issue for us. We're not sitting there having just won or lost a basketball game already having done our jobs. This is our jobs.
Okay. First question, Patrick Obetti, who is kind enough to let us know how to pronounce his name. With the Wizards floundering and Beal out again with a stress reaction in his leg, do you bite the bullet and max him in the hopes that he can give you 65 to 70 games a year, or do you try to move him while his value as a young shooting guard is still pretty high?
The fundamental issue with a lot of kind of questions about moving a guy with certain value is that the same reasons that give the Wizards pause to sign him now are the exact same reasons that another team would be willing to curtail their assets for him. You know, you're not going to get somebody who's going to see him as $1.20 when you see him as 75 cents. And so I think that what you have to do is you kind of have to bite the bullet right now, unless somebody makes a mistake with an offer because of his low cap hold and all of that. But I also am not completely sure that he could get the 5-year max. You know, I'm not sure with him right now, if I were a GM, knowing what we know at this second, if I would feel that much worse giving him a 3+1 than a 5.
So he's only 22, which is, to me, is a reason to get him under contract for longer. The health thing is a concern. On the other hand, you might feel like if you can get him out of Washington, it's not, they haven't had the best health luck or they don't have the best medical staff. You can take that however you want to take it. But I'm sure there are teams that are confident that they could do a better job maybe. So, yeah, we don't have access to his medical records. We don't know necessarily how bad the situation is. But it's important to remember that when you're trading for him, you're not trading for him on this cheap rookie contract. You're trading for him as basically on either a 4-year, you know, almost $100 million deal or a 5-year, almost $125 million deal, depending on, you know, whether he gets an offer sheet in free agency or whether you just give him the 5 years yourself. So, he is a significantly different asset with that contract attached to him. You know, this is the thing that Oklahoma City did last year with Cantor. They knew they were going to have to pay him big bucks, or should have known. Same thing with Detroit and Reggie Jackson. And what this brings me to is the history. I don't recall a pending restricted free agent who was ever traded for more than a first rounder, and that's even a protected first rounder. So I'm not sure what you're going to get if you're Washington that has a higher upside than him. They also still have hopes of doing something in free agency, and the fact that his cap hold is lower than what his eventual salary is almost certain to be, and he is going to get maxed out by somebody, no matter unless he like misses the entire rest of the year or something with this issue, because there's just so much money out there, and he's young, and it's just better to take a risk on a guy like him than someone else. And granted, he hasn't even had an above average PR yet in his career, but given that he plays a position of scarcity, he can shoot the ball, he's young, he should be able to defend okay. All those things, I think he is going to get maxed out one way or another. So I just don't see the point of trading him, because I think you're not going to get back equal value. You don't really have much choice in that. I mean, if you get rid of him, you're not opening up as much cap space as you could use with him eventually. You're basically punting on $7 million in cap space as well. And they may still have some hopes of getting Durant or getting back in the playoff race or whatever. And even if it's not Durant, this is a regime that has kind of staked its entire strategy on this free agency and his small cap hold. I don't think that they would be willing to abandon that yet.
Yeah, I think those are all good points to consider. And there are kind of two different things here. It's if we were the GM versus them, but you have to consider both those. Next question, one I want to ask, is from Eric Black, also because he seems like he specifically asked it to you. You tweeted that old guys like Wade and Gasol torch bad defenses. Why would the performance of old guys be more dependent on the quality of defense relative to young guys?
I think the biggest reason for that, guys like Kobe, Dwayne Wade, Pau Gasol maybe a little bit less, but is that they're kind of relying on guile and other guys' inexperience and getting foul calls. So if it's Dwayne Wade, his pump fake, same thing with Kobe. Gasol, guys who don't know his tricks, how to keep him out of his comfort zone. I think those guys can do really well against those type of players. But if you're, especially guys who aren't that smart, and then just also if you have guys not only who are smarter, but then have really the elite length, those guys or athleticism, those guys are going to be able to really kind of smother those guys because they're not going to go for their fakes, and then they just can't get the ball off over them in a way that, if it's just an average defender or a bad defender, they could. So I think when really good younger players who are more athletic, I think they are a little bit less bothered by a good defense because they're still athletic enough to get their shot off. So, and it's just something I've kind of anecdotally noticed that those guys, Kobe, Wade, and Gasol in particular, are the ones that I really think of with that kind of primary scorer types who are older. They always seem to really struggle against good defenses, but are still able to do well against bad defenses.
I'd also add that you see the example I'm thinking of is I've watched a couple of Rockets game recently, and with that bad defense, teams that can find the seams can do things more like back cutting. Like you saw the way the Warriors, even with a little bit of an older lineup with Andre and guys like that, did a better job of exploiting them than the Jazz did, even though the Jazz are limited in their own ways too, but they were able to exploit it better because they know how to do that.
Yeah, that's another one too. You can backdoor cut, you can get system buckets, all that kind of stuff. Old guys are better at that kind of stuff.
The Gasol Butler lob at the end of what game was that, where they won a game on a lob that...
They run that. I mean, I think they had succeeded with that same play like 10 games in a row or something until the most recent game. Before we move on to the next question, I want to tell you about our sponsor, Audible.com. I've been a subscriber to Audible for over 10 years, and now Audible is even better because they offer WhisperSync technology. If you have a book on your Kindle, Audible is owned by Amazon.com, and so you can start reading your book on your Kindle. You have to go to work that day. Too bad you can't read your book until you get home. No longer is that the case. Now you can just pick up right where you left off, listening to an audiobook on your way to work, and then once you get home, start reading again on your Kindle. I know that I've been reading the Wheel of Time series, and especially towards the end, it's been really awesome as they get to the last battle, and I don't want to stop reading, and so when I get in the car, I don't have to. So that's really awesome, and my listeners can get a free trial for a month with Audible at the URL audibletrial.com/capspace. Capspace is very easy to remember because we talk about it all the time here on the program. All one word. That's audibletrial.com/capspace. And then it's only $15 a month after that. So a great way to support the program and great way to be a lot more cultured than you're going to get on listening to an NBA podcast. All right, this is from Michael Barrett. Real simple one. Are the Spurs now the best team in basketball?
Yeah, I'd say for the moment they are. I mean, it's hard to argue with what they did in December and moving into January. And that doesn't mean they're going to be the best team when we get to May. That just means they're the best team right now.
So if they play, if the Warriors and Spurs play on a neutral court tomorrow, you're picking the Spurs?
With Curry's current limitations, yes.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And Barnes still kind of working back into things. Azealia also hasn't played either. I think with all of those being the case, you would probably go Spurs. I do think the Warriors match up better with the Spurs than the Spurs do with the Warriors. As I've said on past programs, I think that Duncan can be attacked by Steph Curry and pick and roll, and that also Parker is going to really struggle to find someone to guard, but that's just the short way of putting it. I don't think that the Spurs individually have a great matchup against the Warriors' individual defenders, but I think it would be real close. It probably would depend on who had home court right now, but I do, as long as the Warriors are healthy enough, I think I would ultimately pick them.
Makes sense. A question from Takao Yamada. What are some players from the recent past whose careers would be most transformed by moving to the modern NBA? And he wanted to exclude obvious superstars, and his example was Detlef Schrempf, but you can give your own.
Oh, yeah, I missed the obvious superstars. The couple that came to mind for me were Bill Laimbeer, who was a very good defensive center back in the day, could move his feet a little bit better and contest at the rim a little bit better than you might expect. I mean, think of him as sort of like a Zaza Pachulia type defensively, but also a guy who had three-point range and actually held the NBA record, I think, for most three-pointers in a game. He hit like NBA Finals record for most three-pointers in a game. I think he hit like five or six or something. So he would clearly be encouraged to do more of that offensively. So if you imagine him as sort of like a Channing Frye on offense and a Zaza Pachulia on defense, that's like a pretty darn good player.
Yeah, the guy that I thought of was Mark Price. I think Mark Price is probably in...
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, he's a guy who I think would have been, especially with coaching and things like that, he would be a monster now.
Yeah, I mean, he would have kind of been more like a Steve Nash before Steve Nash. One of the, I mean, not quite the passing vision, but certainly an excellent shooter. Maybe not quite also the finisher that Nash was. Didn't quite have that size either. And obviously not the durability that Nash had. But yeah, that is a really good one. One of the other ones I had is Rasheed Wallace.
I love that one.
He would be a center now, probably, and was really athletic. He could run pick and roll. He could shoot threes. He could post up guys on switches really well. I think that would be a really good one. You know, and we're not talking even like Detroit version of Rasheed Wallace. We're talking like, you know, 2000, 2001, Portland Rasheed Wallace.
I thought you were going to say Atlanta Hawks Rasheed Wallace.
Yeah, for like that 1 week.
Yeah, I think it was even less than a week. Like one game.
Yeah, did you have any other ones? I kind of cheated, I guess, because my reading comprehension is apparently poor at the time. I also said Reggie Miller and Ray Allen, especially Ray Allen, because Ray Allen could play in pick and roll and he could shoot threes off the dribble. And especially with more of a space floor instead of, you know, playing with like Irvin Johnson at center or so, or like Scott Williams or something like he did on some of those Bucks teams. I mean, I think he could be not the passer and not the ball handling wizard that Steph Curry is, but the type of guy who could break defense, and actually a guy who was back in his early in his career was really athletic, even was in the dunk contest 1 year with a space floor. I think he would be more unstoppable than he was. You know, we're talking again about, you know, how he was early in his career when he was more of the guy who would handle and pick and roll and really create stuff, more than just the spot up guy that he was in Boston.
The other guy I just thought of him is Drazen Petrovic. I think he would be really awesome now. He would have been great then if he had been able to keep playing, if he hadn't suffered the car accident and all that. And another random guy that I just thought of when you were talking about opening is, I think Brent Berry would do pretty well now.
Oh yeah, like a young Brent Berry. Yeah, that's an interesting one actually. It's funny, like to me, he just like instantly morphed from 1996 warm up wearing dunk contest winner to guy who just hung out in the corner on the Sonics and the Spurs and shot threes. But yeah, I'm sure that, and then he had like a year with the Bulls. Like he really wallowed on some bad teams back when he still had his athleticism. But yeah, that's an interesting thought. He could have been another one of those guys that might have been a little bit better.
Hasia, maybe
nowadays.
He did quite well though.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that he would have been that much better in today's rule because he was never going to handle in pick and roll, and he also played on a team that was pretty enlightened already.
That's true.
And made about the best use of the skills that he could. So, yeah, I wouldn't say that he would necessarily be all that much better. I mean, maybe they'd just tell him to gun even more from three. But I mean, I think he was getting as many. I mean, he averaged like 24 a game 1 year.
Yeah.
Like 03-04, the year that Chris Webber missed with the microfracture. All right, let me do one here. Obviously, his current team's setup would rarely, if ever, require it, but is Kawhi capable of guarding centers for short periods like Draymond?
Sure. I don't know really why you would do it. I think that's a poor use of his strengths. I mean, if you're going to have, I guess the idea is switching everything, but I don't see why. He's a little bit weak. I would say his strength, just at like particularly in the lower body, seems a little bit weaker than Draymond's. But yeah, he could do it. I wouldn't recommend it, but why not?
I don't think he could. I think he would just get. I mean, against a true center, I think he would just get back down a
like
little
Marc
Gasol
bit
more than Draymond. Yeah, I mean Draymond has successfully guarded Marc Gasol in the post. And Kawhi, I mean, he's better at stripping even than Draymond is, but I think Draymond is strong enough to not get backed down by a lot of guys, and I don't think that Kawhi is. So I don't think he would be anywhere near the post defender against centers that Draymond would be. And then also, you would wonder whether Kawhi could hold up on the defensive glass as well as Draymond either, and protect the rim as well. I don't think that Kawhi, just as a straight rim protector, compares to Draymond. I mean, maybe if that were more of his role, we might see that. He certainly has long arms, but Draymond just kind of has those big man instincts. That's something that's hard to hone. So no, I don't think he would be anywhere close to Draymond as a center defensively.
One that you can answer far better than I, considering your experience from Austin Peters, of all basketball writers and bloggers out there, who's the best at pickup basketball?
Oh, this is a good one. The best game that I ever saw for anyone was that 2012 Sloan, when Beckley Mason, who I don't think really writes about basketball anymore, he played in college and had a bunch of knee problems, but he was awesome. I was on the same team as him, and it was actually like the first time I had played in probably like a year and a half since I tore my ACL and patellar tendon and meniscus simultaneously. But so he made me look really good on like the pick and roll finishes, and he was just hitting three pointers all over the place, was unguardable. That was like the best NBA blogger pickup game performance that I've seen. I've never had the privilege of playing with him again. Seth is pretty good shooting the three. He's he played college. If you leave him open, he will drain it. Especially if he's on the other team. For me, when he's on my team, he can't make a shot. But so just put him opposite me, and then he immediately becomes a superstar. Let's see. Ethan's pretty good.
Yeah. Ethan torched me when they decided to be mean and put me on him.
Yeah, he's got a nice shot, and he actually has pretty good stamina. He'll get out on the break. He's got a nice sort of like 1 foot layup game, good energy. I've heard that Adam Maris is pretty good out in Denver, but I've never had a chance to play with him.
Oh, and then we played that game with McMenamin where he hit like every single shot during the finals.
Yeah, he was going to be the next one. I mean, I don't know if you actually like get out on him how good he is. If he can do much more than that, but he's definitely one of the best shooters And if I'm actually healthy, I'm still pretty good. I'm just never healthy, so I can't put myself in that category anymore. Maybe this year Sloan will be the time. Of course, I was trying to like train so I could play in the pickup games at the D-League Showcase, and then I pulled my calf muscle on Sunday playing with Rosgold and Wude, and limped to the sidelines, and now I'm out of commission for who knows how long. So, yeah, I'm too off-injured and unreliable, so I can't put myself in that category right now.
The lesson, of course, is to never try.
Never try. All right, before we get to our next question, please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors. This is a difficult one that I didn't even have that great of an answer to, so that's why I will give it to you first.
Oh, God.
This is from Cengiz Khan. Who do you think is the best player moved at this year's trade deadline? What are some realistic landing spots for him, and what kind of package will it take to acquire him?
So I have more on the player, and this, of course, this is not inside information. It's just my own intuition. I talked about this a little bit with Kevin Pelton on Real Jib Radio, but my instinct is that it's Dwight Howard. I think that he has the ability to opt out and become a free agent. There is this lingering possibility that Houston could not be better without him, but, you know, not lose as much. Clint Capella is an option. They just have other uses for their cap space. In terms of teams, it's actually kind of interesting because a lot of teams that are good actually kind of have their centers of the future. Like almost any interesting middle 20s, early 30s guy, I think about the Celtics because the Celtics have flexibility to do something like that. I toyed with the idea of the Pacers just because of the idea, but the hard thing for Dwight in this sense is, like when I talked about the Chris Paul thing in the piece I wrote for Sporting News, is an ideal situation would be one that not only could use him right now, but would have a reasonable expectation of signing him this upcoming summer, and that's why I think Boston is there. I have no idea what the package would be, but my instinct is that if the question is who is the best player moved, I think it's Dwight.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen just because, as you said, I think it's hard to identify a logical destination for him that also would be willing to throw in enough to make it worthwhile for Houston to, A, give up on one of their big free agent acquisitions, and B, almost certainly get worse for this year, and C, give up any chance of potentially re-signing when you don't know necessarily what the market is going to be for him either. You know, if you're going to pay him 3 years, $20 million, maybe it's okay. If you have to pay him 5 years, $25 million a year, then, or he's demanding just a full max, then maybe not. So I think it's just too hard for me to see a destination for him. Depending on what you think of Markieff Morris, that's a totally reasonable one. And I do think, I don't have a great name, but I have a category. I think that someone, at least, who is going to be a restricted free agent from that 2012 draft class is going to get dealt because they're just going to feel like we don't want to pay this guy that much. You know, it'll be the Reggie Jackson and his Cantor type of trade. And I mean, one of the big problems in this exercise though is A, the free agent class is pretty weak, and B, there aren't that many teams that are out of it right now. So, and we don't necessarily know what those teams are going to be. I mean, if there are going to be trades, it's generally going to be the sellers or teams that are out of it. So that's why I had such difficulty answering this question. And, you know, it could be, and for teams that want to, like, dump salary or whatever, you know, it's hard to really say who that might be at this point. So none of those players are really that sexy. I'm still expecting a pretty docile trade deadline, but, you know, we maybe thought that last year, and that was not the case.
Since it's a Bulls question, I feel it's good to ask you. From Mike Manovich, why doesn't Taj Gibson guard threes when the Bulls start big, so meaning they start Mirotić as well? Wouldn't that be a lot more palatable?
No, because Jimmy Butler takes the worst of the two wing threats, or, as far as, like, what they're going to do to the Bulls. And so then Nikola Mirotić will have the easier wing matchup. And then Gibson is so much better protecting the rim and in pick-and-roll defense than Mirotić, although Mirotić is not that bad, as we've said before. But there's no reason to sacrifice Gibson's ability to protect the rim, defend in the post, defensive rebound, and play pick-and-roll defense. And maybe Gibson might even really be better at switching anyway. So I think that it's just you're hurting yourself. Mirotić isn't really getting beaten by whoever he's guarding anyway, and you're then hurting your interior defense as well, so I don't really see much point to doing that. Although, I mean, I understand where the question is coming from, because if you said, all right, who's going to do a better job one-on-one, Taj Gibson probably might be a little bit better on like an ISO against another team's three. But I think in the grand total of things, you would rather have Gibson defending the basket than Mirotić, yes. Especially when Mirotić is guarding someone that's not that good.
And his help on the interior, I think Mirotić is a little bit better than some people think there, but I think Gibson is way better. And so you even think about it in that capacity of just stopping a drive or something. If he's guarding a two, then he's in the wrong place.
This is from Greg Mead. Is it bad for the league that there's so little parity? It seems like everyone has agreed the finals would be either Warriors-Cavs or Spurs-Cavs. When the league is trying to fill stadiums for 1,230 games, it's tough if only 14 games will actually matter.
Sort of. I think that it would be, in terms of in-person, the television ratings, I think. Of course, if there are teams that are terrible, that's definitely not a good thing. But superstar teams are generally something that really galvanizes people. You can see that the Warriors ratings have been really good. I think the ratings for Warriors, I'm not even sure if it was Warriors Cavs or one of the other games as part of the win streak, was like the best game since one of the best regular season games recently. In terms of in person, one of the kind of benefits, if you want to call it that, of relying on a season ticket base, which a lot of teams do, is that you're not really concerning yourself with that. You're trying to make that money committed anyway. And from what I can tell, I think a lot of teams are doing pretty well with that. Teams started the year with hope, and hopefully they'll finish the year with hope. And that's really enough. And yeah, I think that there are enough players of interest, I would say, around the league. You can talk about Kobe. Like, even though the Lakers are terrible, people want to go see him. And there are players like that that can galvanize and that people want to see all over, depending on what kind of basketball fans you have in your town.
Yeah, and maybe at least in the East, you can say that there's more hope, because really anybody could get to the East Finals to lose to the Cavs. But, I think that ultimately what's most important for the league is really good ratings in the playoffs, and to have great teams that people really are interested in that are going to pull casual fans in. I think that people who are big fans of the league are going to watch it regardless of whether, their team has 47 wins or 41 wins or 50 wins or 55 wins. But people who are casual fans want to tune in to see a dominant team like the Warriors, Steph Curry, Riley Curry, LeBron James, that kind of stuff. Having a top-heavy league is not the end of the world. I wouldn't mind if there were a little bit more in the East, but I don't think that it hurts the league very much.
From Reggie Mickles, who should the Hawks keep in the long run, Jeff Teague or Dennis Schroeder? And any players that you think the Hawks should make a run at that would make the team better?
So the long run we'll think of as 2017. That's when Teague's contract expires. That's when Dennis Schroeder's contract expires. He'll become a restricted free agent. Schroeder, to me, has not shown enough to prove that he will be anything more than kind of a lower-end starting point guard right now. Still very young. He has some talent, but he's going to have to get better at a lot of things. He turns the ball over too much. His vision is not unbelievable. He misses shooters a lot when he's in the pick and roll. His finishing, he's got like an okay floater, but it's still kind of speed layups, just kind of beat the guy to the rim. He doesn't have a ton of craft outside of that. He can't shoot at all when they go under on the pick and roll or when he's spotting up. And that's a lot of things that he's got to get better at to really be a guy that you're like, yes, this is our starting point guard for the next 4 years. We don't need to upgrade in this spot. Teague, on the other hand, is going to be 29. And he's a guy who's 6 foot, dependent on athleticism, not the greatest shooter himself, getting to an age where it's hard to project that he's going to get that much better at that skill. So past 2017, right now, I would have to say neither, frankly. But, that 2017 is also a great point guard class, so maybe they could get in on someone who would be better at that time, or they could draft someone. But, I wouldn't be I wouldn't say that we are set with either of those guys, considering the age and where they're at right now. What do you think?
I'm more concerned with Schroeder because, especially given the Hawks' specific talent, one of the responsibilities of the guy defending point guards is running the offense, and Schroeder at this point has not shown me that he's going to be doing that reliably when he's, let's say, 25, 28, you know, whatever. And he could get there, certainly. Absolutely he could. But for me, and we'll get to this in some later questions, I think, I trust what I've seen more than potential, because being the guy in an offense is something that's really hard. It's something that a lot of talented players never get. Also, I think he'll get a lot better on defense, but until we really see some of those inklings, he's a guy who it's more about physical potential than actual realization, and the longer that takes, the less confident I am in it. So I agree with you that it's neither. I would be much more confident in Teague right now. And what's really challenging...
Yeah, but Teague's going to be 29, right. Though. If we're talking about after then, yeah. It's sad to me that I think Teague projects to still be better...
Right.
At that point, and that's when the difficulty really arises, because at 29, how much longer are you going to think that T can keep it up, and do you really want to commit another big contract to him? I thought that actually he might be a decent candidate for a renegotiate and extend, depending on what happens with their cap space this summer.
And the Hawks are in a really sticky spot because there are more teams right now with cap space than usual, and Atlanta's a city that, from what I've heard, players do enjoy, but will they be the top on anybody's list is really hard, because you're going to need to be somebody's number one to get them this time. And you talked about how it is a good point guard class, and it is, but to get a Russell Westbrook, to get a Stephen Curry, you're not going to need to be in the room. You're going to need to be the best in the room. And I think that's going to be hard for them.
Yeah. On the other hand, they have developed their internal guys really well. I mean, you look at what Millsap has done since he's gone there. Damari Carroll, Kent Bazemore is having a wonderful year now. Even Korver made some strides. And it's a little weird that Schroeder has kind of disappointed in some respects. So, I mean, it's not a decision that needs to be made now. Maybe Schroeder will come into his own next year and he'll be ready to go forward and they'll be ready to pay him. You know, that's the other thing. I mean, he's not going to be cheap forever. You're going to have to commit to one of those guys at least eight figures, you know, probably $15 million a year. If any of them are good. So we still have a long way to go, but it's not looking that great in either direction right now.
I think it's your turn.
I think so too. All right. Well, let's see. What do we have here?
I can ask one to myself if you want.
All right, here we go. This is from Jason Liu. What players do you think have the biggest difference in public perception versus actual contributions on the court, either in a positive or negative way?
It's a really interesting question, partially because I think it's changed a lot over the last couple of years. Like, for a long time, like probably the last like 4 years or up till that, I thought it was Kobe. You know, I thought Kobe was a guy who, especially once his defense kind of faded away, that he was like that. But now people have that about right.
He is starting the All-Star game still.
That's because people think he's good. I think that's because they care on a personal level and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to go in a direction I think is going to surprise you. And the reason for that is he's a guy who is going to be very good in the future, but is not that right now, and that's Andrew Wiggins. Like, Wiggins is a guy who I love his potential. When we did that podcast of the top prospects. But when you look at, you know, his overall contributions, he's not there yet. And people, I think, are already there. He won Rookie of the Year thinking, oh, well, this guy, you know, he's a key contributor on a good team. And I just don't see him there yet. He will be. I have full confidence he will be, but he's not there yet.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? The kind of the two categories that jump out at you are, and it's weird how we will do this. We're really like kind of optimists with a lot of players, right? When it's a young guy, I think people get ahead of themselves thinking he's good before he is, right? Like, do you remember, like, I think going into his third year, for example, Kyrie Irving was number 7 in NBA rank. And that was just ridiculous. Like, he's not even number 7 now or close to it. 2 years later, when he's on a really good team and the Cavs totally disappointed that year. And Wiggins, I think, you know, same thing. He's scoring 20 a game. He's also like at like the very bottom of the league in RPM for a pretty good reason. And, you know, we've talked a lot on previous shows in the last couple of weeks about why that is. So that's one, I think, category is just kind of a young player where we're really getting ahead of ourselves on this guy. I mean, Kristaps Porzingis is probably another one, frankly. Although he has been the rare rookie who's actually been a positive for his team, so maybe I'm being too hard there. And then the other ones is, for old guys, we do the opposite, right? Like, we don't adjust, we sort of don't project into the future enough, or even right now, we sort of look at what they were 2 years ago. And so, like, Dwayne Wade, I think, is up there for me. He's had some good clutch moments this year, but defensively, he really doesn't do much anymore. He's not particularly efficient. I think he kind of takes away from moving the ball. He's a record scratch guy at times, doesn't space the floor when he doesn't have the ball. And just because he scores and has a high usage, I think he is still pretty overrated. I don't think he can score against good defense, and he's not incredibly efficient anymore. So all those things, Pau Gasol is another guy who falls into that category, as well as a guy who puts up a lot of counting stats, but they don't really rebound that well when he's on the floor. He's not particularly efficient when he's gets the ball in the post. I mean, he's like a below average true shooting percentage, which is not very good for a center. So those are the two that I point to as being like overrated. Is there anyone that you feel like is rated too low right now?
I'm sure there is, but I'm trying to think about, like, really, like, that would be more like maybe somebody who's obscure. Like, I think Rodney Hood is better than people say he is. But again, that's not really in terms of his contribution. I just think he's a guy who's just underappreciated. Maybe Gordon Hayward in kind of the same degree. But I'm trying to think of anybody who, I mean, Draymond might have been there two years ago.
Yeah, I got a couple. I think one of the big archetypes for this one is guys either who are real good defenders, or guys who space the floor but don't put up a crap ton of stats themselves. Whether it is, like, Channing Frye would be one. We talked about him on the program a couple days ago. I think actually Nikola Mirotic is still one too, where especially when he's playing the four, that they usually tend to do pretty well, even when his shot is not necessarily falling. And then he's also a better defender than people think, just because he's, like, you know, kind of a weak-looking Euro. And he's actually okay defensively. So that's kind of the direction I would look at. Those type of guys who space the floor for others. J.J. Redick would be another one,
oh,
too.
Oh, that's a great one.
That people don't realize exactly how good he is.
Derek Favors? I'm naming every guy on the Utah Jazz.
Yeah, that could be one, just because I think people, that's more a situation of people just not following him enough and just not knowing what he is doing, as opposed to just not having, kind of knowing what he's doing, but not knowing that those things that he's doing are important. I think it's more the former than the latter with him.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
All right, that's probably enough on that question. What do we got for you?
Okay, so I'll phrase it a little bit different. No, actually phrase it that way. So how meaningful is net rating when it gets above 10 to 15? So, like, when there's a big blowout, like, does basically the question, I think, is from Daniel Lawrence, is does net rating, does it kind of overstate things in a blowout?
You know, I guess there's two ways you can take the question. One is basically, you know, if you win by more than 15 points, should that count? You know, should that go into our assessment of team quality? And studies who have assessed that have shown that, yes, indeed, you know, winning by 40 points is more significant than winning by 15 or 20, even if the game is significantly less in doubt. On the other hand, there's a way of looking at it as, all right, you know, what's happening in the fourth quarter once the starters leave? The Warriors have terrible scrubs. The Spurs, just due to their system or because they've identified end-of-the-bench guys better, or even just because those guys fit together and they don't have three centers as, like, the three worst guys on their team the way the Warriors do. You know, I think once you are into true garbage time, that doesn't really matter that much either. But I think most studies have just shown that more is better in those kind of situations.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
All right, this is one that I enjoyed from Jacob Boyd. Pure speculation question, the kind we enjoy the most. Based on the players in the league currently, who are starters for the 2020 All-Star Game?
So the way that I did this was I didn't do, like, position by position. I thought that was going to be a little bit complicated. I just basically made a list of dudes and then ran from there.
Yeah, yeah. I just picked who I thought would be the top 10 best players. I didn't know who was going to be in each conference then. That was also too much work. But I think it's more interesting to me. And LeBron, like, he's going to be 36, but he's still going to get voted in. I didn't want to go through all that. So I basically just tried to pick who I thought would be the top 10 players in the 2019-2020 season.
So do you want to do this? Yeah, do you want to do this? Like, I say a name and then you say if they're on your list?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, so 26-year-old Anthony Davis.
Yes.
24-year-old Karl Anthony Towns.
Yes.
26-year-old Andre Drummond.
Yes.
28-year-old Kawhi Leonard.
Yes.
27-year-old Kyrie Irving.
Yes.
25-year-old Giannis.
I did not have Giannis on there.
He'd be 25. How ludicrous is that?
Because I don't think he's ever going to be a top 10 player.
I think that's fair. You know, Giannis is a guy
I think he's... Yeah, and you might see it differently. I just don't think he's going to be quite a good enough offensive player. Or actually, defensively, too. You know, he's not really like a stopper defensively either. I think he's almost like too big, and so he's like too easily screened. There's just like too much of him to be able to he's too easy to screen, so there's just too much of him.
I agree with a lot of that. What gives me kind of hesitation with it is Paul George doing so well in the voting this year. I mean, obviously he's more of a scorer and he's a little bit more famous now. Actually, incidentally, maybe partially because of the injury. But I think Giannis, you know, in 4 years can get that. Oh, and that's the other fun thing about this is it's 4 years. And the ages that I'm doing, that's the Basketball Reference age. It might be slightly off for some guys. I don't care. 31-year-old Stephen Curry.
Yeah, I had him in there. I think his game's going to age pretty well. And even if his individual statistics go down a little bit, I think he's just still going to be such a threat that he's still going to be on really good offensive teams, even if he's only scoring, you know, 22 a game instead of 24 like he did last year, or 30 like he is this year.
31-year-old and possibly at that time Curry teammate Kevin Durant.
I went with KD. I think any time you're talking about a guy who's 30 or older, he better have been, you know, being a top 10 player, he better be like a top 2 or 3 player when he's 27, because that's just what happens when you're 30, 31, you decline. I mean, even if you look at LeBron, you know, I think we would say he's more, you know, top 3, top 4 player right now as he's turning 31, and in my opinion, he's the second greatest player of all time. So I think that's, I'm loath to pick anyone older than that, and it's only because Steph and KD are so good right now, and because I think their games will age pretty well, that I have them on the list. But they are by far the oldest.
Yeah, same for me. A guy who was not on my list originally, and I decided to put him on, a 24-year-old Kristaps Porzingis.
Yeah, I don't think so, just because I don't think he's going to be that good of an individual scorer. I think he'll be a very valuable player, but I don't see him as becoming a awesome one-on-one threat who's going to be able to create for himself or others. I think he could be, you know, a top 30 player almost certainly. Well, not almost certainly, but likely. And then, you know, maybe a top 20 player, but top 10, that's really, you know, that's asking a lot.
And my last one is somebody, I went through like 6 different guys for this, and I'm almost positive you won't have him on your list, is DeMarcus Cousins.
So he will be 29 at that point? Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I think he is on the fringes of the top 10 now. I had him at like number 8 last year. I think with all the guys who have come back from injury this year, I would have him out of the top 10 this year. And he's also, I don't think, playing as well as he was at least early last year. And I do think also that his game is not going to age that well. I think he already has. You know, suffers from limited explosiveness, gets his shot blocked a lot, takes too many jumpers, and I don't think, you know, defensively his quickness, maybe you could say because his attitude will be better then, but, you know, it hasn't improved that much So yeah, I would think he would be, you know, top 20 maybe, but not not quite there. So is that all
That's
yours?
That's my 10.
Okay, I think the only ones that I had, I guess people would say, where's Wiggins? Again, I think, you know, the odds are against him right now becoming a top 10 player, even if you believe in him, just because he has so many flaws in his game still that he's got to fix. He could fix them. He's got a lot of potential, but I think when you look at whether that's likely or not, that he really gets into the absolute top 10 stratosphere, you know, that's difficult. John Wall and Ben Simmons were my other two.
Oh, and probably Paul George, right?
Yeah, I did put Paul
George. Was my last cut. Because George will be 29 then. That's certainly an age that can work. I just thought I have this weird idea that DeMarcus Cousins is going to be awesome in his late 20s. I don't know why. Maybe it's just my irrational love for that man that he'll figure something out.
Yeah, and I guess
I'm shocked you didn't have Jabari.
I cheated. Yeah. I still think that he, you know, because of his, I think he'll be a top 10 scorer in the league, maybe. But overall, I'm not sure about that. Yeah, and Ben Simmons, I guess he said based on players in the league currently, but I cheated and put him in there because I think he is going to be pretty good. We'll see, though. It's only been a little bit of a college season for him, but I think you got to have at least one guy who's not in the league yet who, you know, would be a fourth-year player or so.
Well, LeBron...
And then and John Wall, I'm not sure about either. I mean, his lack of shooting by the time he gets that old, that could be an issue. I mean, I guess the other person I consider maybe was Jimmy Butler at 29, but I think he's not necessarily even a top 10 player now. So to say that at 29 he'll be better than he is at, like, what, 25, 26, it seems unlikely to me.
I think it's hard to put him over Paul George considering what we know right now.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. I think just because George is a little bit taller, more of a shooter, better rebounder. I think he would age a little bit better. But, yeah, I mean, there are definitely going to be plenty of people. I mean, nobody saw Jimmy Butler being this good. I mean, it would be interesting to go back and do this exercise retroactively from 4 years ago and see who would be on the list of the top 10. When I do my top 10 list in March, we'll have to remember to actually kind of go back and see, like, all right, how many of these guys, if you were doing this 4 years ago, would have showed up on your list trying to predict it.
Well, yeah, and I have a list, I think it was from 2012 or 2013, of the kind of the concept of a fantasy draft, so going through it, I'd be interested to see how that's aged, too.
Yeah. All right, who's next here? We got maybe time for, like, two more?
Yeah, I think we have time for about two more. I'll go with one I think we both have thoughts on this, from Ethan Giles. Will the incoming cap spike make draft picks more or less valuable going forward?
The answer is more valuable.
Yeah.
Easy.
The only thing I'll say about that, in addition to that, I wrote a piece on it for Sporting News, is it will depend a little bit on how the new CBA handles it. You know, like, obviously this year's are really, really valuable, but they might change the rookie scale. But odds are, just based on the structural incentives, it's very unlikely that they will give youngsters more power and give them more money. So they'll pretty much always be valuable, and they're going to be awesome next year, though.
Yeah, I think it could at least be pegged to the cap in future years, potentially. And I talked to a couple of people at the showcase today who felt like, you know, that would be fair to at least have it go up, you know, more than it is now, when, you know, it's basically you're paying rookies at the bottom of the first round, you know, 1% of the salary cap, you know, in a couple of years. That seems pretty ridiculous. All right. But yeah, I mean, clearly the more the cap rises, the rookie scale doesn't rise, makes them more valuable, especially too when you consider that now more teams have cap space, so trying to build your team through free agency is arguably harder than it ever was because there's more competition if you really want to try and go that route. So if you're not hitting your draft picks and you don't have a foundation already in place, you're probably not getting free agents, so it's more difficult to build your team.
Yeah, and also think about the competitive advantage in, like, a year or two. If a team has half of their roster spots, if they don't expand rosters with draft picks and minimum salary guys, I mean, then you can spend an insane amount of money on the few guys you have left.
All right, last one of the day. Max N. Schlusener. Other than Pop, which coach has the highest trade value, and what return could you reasonably expect? And before I get your answer. Let's just remind people of kind of how trading coaches works. You don't get to trade them on your existing contract. Essentially, what you are doing is trading a draft pick, and the other team says, okay, we will let this guy out of his contract. So, and that's what happened with Doc Rivers. He had, I think, 3 years and $21 million left on his contract with Boston, and they just let him out of that, and he signed a similar deal with the Clippers, and then I think he signed another extension once Ballmer took over. But, all right, so given those constraints, so it's not like, oh, hey, we got Brad Stevens for 3 more years, we'll just trade him. That adds more. That's not the case. It's basically you're just getting the right to sign him to a new contract. So given those constraints, what do you think, Danny?
I think it's Rick Carlisle. And you could go with – there are a couple different guys that I considered. But I think Carlisle, he's done such a great job, particularly this year, I would say, with the Mavericks, of regularly getting his teams into the playoffs in a – Western Conference that is more demanding than kind of what Stevens has done. He's only 56, so it's not like he's on so much older than a guy, let's say, like Steve Kerr, who was somebody else I consider. Also, I don't think he has the health stuff that Steve does. So what the return would be, I mean, it definitely wouldn't be like a high first. Like, I don't think it would be maybe like 2 picks in the 20s, like something like that. But I mean, maybe a little bit higher. I think he's a great coach.
Yeah, that's interesting. Carlisle would be up there for me, although he is a little bit more prickly than some. I think I would ultimately go with Kerr just because I trust him a little bit more as kind of an emotional leader and communicator. And I think that is something that's really important as far as like getting free agents and just his reputation, working with the front office, getting along with everybody. You know, he doesn't have the track record of Carlisle, and you could say, all right, how good is he going to be without Curry and all these guys? Brad Stevens would be up there too, especially just because of how young he is. You would feel like you would be, if you wanted to keep him for that long, and he certainly has done a nice job, although he's not, you know, proven at a championship level the way some of the other guys are. Is there anyone else that you would even consider outside of those three?
Huh. Off the top of my head, no. I think that was the group that I really thought about. It's funny. Did you think the exact same three?
What about Mike Budenholzer?
I like him a lot. I would give up an asset for him, but not the same type of thing I would give up for those guys.
All right. So now the question is, how much would what would be the trade value?
So I think for Carlisle, I said 2 low firsts. I don't know that I definitely wouldn't, but I would maybe give up a pick. Let's say if it was a single pick, like 11 to 14, I think that'd probably be the best I would consider.
So let's go back and look at history. It's a little instructive here, right? Like Doc Rivers was probably considered a top 5 coach at the time that he moved to the Clippers. Maybe his star has dimmed slightly since then, although maybe more as a, just due to his executive foibles than his actions as a coach. But the only way a coach ever gets traded is if he actually wants out, right? And that's why, and then once he wants out, the leverage for the trading team becomes much, much lower, right? This transaction never happens. Nobody is ever going to go to the Warriors right now and say, hey, we'd like to trade for Steve Kerr. The trade only happens if the coach is already unhappy. And you remember Tom Thibodeau, the Bulls couldn't trade him, right? Like they, and that's because they knew that he wanted, or I don't know if he wanted out, but that they were going to fire him. But maybe even in a case like Rivers, where Rivers wanted out, like these discussions don't even happen unless the guy wants to leave. And then you know that teams aren't going to want to bring back a guy who doesn't necessarily want to be there anymore. So I don't think we will ever see a coach traded for more than kind of a low first-round pick, certainly not 2 first-round picks. Now, if you're just asking me if a coach could be traded against his will and what would it be worth, if I had a team that was ready to be good and I had sort of an average coach and you could get me a Steve Kerr or and I wouldn't put Stevens quite in his category, but a Steve Kerr or a Greg Popovich, I might give up two first-round picks for that, but only if it makes sense for where your franchise is. If you have enough talent where you feel like, all right, if we can get this awesome coach, that's going to put us over the edge. And also you're good enough where those two first round picks are going to be in the 20s, then yeah, I might go for two, but that's not really, that's never realistic because you're only trading the coach if he already wants out.
Right. I think that's a more measured way of looking at it, but that is kind of what my thought process was without saying it.
All right. That will do it for today's mailbag. You got anything to plug?
I'll have a Real GM Radio out tomorrow with my boss, Chris Reyna, who's one of the main content guys at Real GM. He wrote a piece on the, I guess you'd call it the portfolios of each team. And so we kind of talked about it, his process and going through it. And it was fun. It'll come out at some point tomorrow. I still need to edit it eventually.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing Chris. Has he ever been on the podcast before?
He has not.
All right, no, that'll be awesome.
Yeah, so I had one boss on like a month ago. Have another boss on. We recorded today.
All right. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Obviously, the Facebook page NateDuncanNBA is where you can submit these mailbag questions. Keep up with my writing. Danny is Danny LaRue NBA on that. And if you'd like to support the program, there is that Audible code, which is audibletrial.com/capspace. Or if you're not in a buying mood, an iTunes review or rating is always much appreciated as well. So thanks very much for listening, and we will talk to you all next time.